Listen to WGN Radio's newest podcast, Behind the Badge, Illinois, hosted by David Hochberg. Behind the Badge, Illinois views current events through the eyes of Illinois law enforcement leaders. Tune in. Visit WGNradio.com/behindthebadge.
Okay, everything's ready in the booth. Levels are set. Talent is ready out here in the studio, that's for sure, as always. Jot it down, episode 124. 124. All right, are we ready? Three S's, Jim. Star. Smile. Strong. Okay, gang, ready? Three, two, one. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. Right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, new episode is posted for your listening and binging pleasure. And if you would like to binge, by all means, go to my landing page at WGNplus.com. Go to the entertainment section. You will see the Elton Jim Captain Podtastic prompt. Click on that and you will find all previous 123 episodes. Which of course means this is episode 124. Yes, I am back 124 times. Thank you, as always, for scanning your dial. Boy, there's a phrase that dates you, huh? No more dials to scan. Now we click and swipe and surf and whatever else it is that you do to find us here on a regular basis. Your efforts are much appreciated, and we certainly do our best to make it worth your while here at the podcast. So, what I want to talk about today is a lesson in be careful, Jim, what you say, because it may come back to bite you. So, a few podcasts ago, I don't know the exact number. That's another reason. We call in the business that's a tease or to make you go back, or a callback, if you will, to go back and find exactly what I'm talking about. So, this way we continue to have the listener mining our previous podcasts. Just a little behind the scenes as to how we work here. It's a transparent society now. That those things used to be just kind of subliminal, but now everything needs to be transparent. So, yeah. But actually, as I said, what's kind of good about, if you do go back to the landing page, very often in this continuing dialogue that I'm hopefully creating with you, hopefully people are returning guests to the podcast. Yeah, sometimes it is good to listen to an older one to hear what I've maybe talked about on a specific topic because I will frequently come back to those some topics that I've talked about either as an update or an addendum, if you will. And I don't know what this would fall into, an update or an addendum. So it's up for your interpretation. But so a few podcasts ago, as I said, go back to the landing page, Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and you'll see the headline on it. I was bragging, who me, about my deductive skills, mainly in that podcast about lost items. And I was very proud of myself about finding a lost item by the simple deduction of retracing steps. And in this particular, I've talked about losing items and deducting things. Now, this specific thing, I was actually talking about my deductive skills. I have talked about how I left a pair of my sunglasses one time in a clothing store on a shelf with a bunch of shirts, and actually went home. And while I was home, I went to get my sunglasses and they weren't there. And I was looking throughout the house to see where they could be. And then I'm retracing my steps. And I wound up going back, thankfully, to the clothing store, which was not far from my house. Went back into the section where the shirts are. And sure enough, there were my glasses, just sitting there as I had placed them. I had them on. For whatever reason, I must have had them in my hand. I went to look at a shirt. I put them down. I didn't buy the shirt. I left the store, and thankfully, the glasses were still there. So I was bragging about the importance to always backtrack, trace your steps, and yes, you will indeed find something. And in fact, this happened again to me just this past week. Our cat, Grimsby, has a string with a little kind of frilly toy on the end. And she doesn't really play with it. It's amazing how smart animals and pets can be. When she, it sits downstairs with a few of her little balls that she likes to play with too every so often. Many times she will take that string and bring it to where either I am or my wife is to signal to us that she is hungry and there is no food in her bowl. It's amazing. I don't know how she thought of the string. I don't know how we realized what the string meant. But we were all vibing together. And so now when we see this string in another room or when she places it where we are and she meows, we know that she is hungry. And so the string was taken from downstairs upstairs because we were upstairs and it was there overnight. We saw the string up. Grimsby's hungry. Gave her some food. Didn't bring the string back down. So the next morning, I went and brought the string because the string. This way, she knows where her string is. So I brought the string. I take the string, and then of course I'm, as I will be, a Felix Unger, always fastidious. Always, everything needs to be in its place. So, I started to go around the house and clean the little waste basket in the bathroom and what everything else is some old, an empty cat food can and whatever was lying around. I was picking things up, putting them in my hand, and went downstairs, threw everything out. Later in the day, I notice that Grimsby's string is not where it should be. And so I say, what the heck did I do with the string? Oh, I must have left it upstairs. Went upstairs, looked in all the spots, traced my steps, went to all the spots where I was. No string. Then it dawned on me. Yes. I had her string in my hand with all of the other things that I was going to throw away. And in my haste and in my zest to have everything clean and in its place, I bet you I did not separate the string from the other things I had in my hand, some paper towels and some, Kleenex and things like that. Sure enough, went to the garbage can. There's the string. Tracing steps, backtracking. Now, as I said in a previous podcast, I was talking about my deductive skills. And I was very proud of the fact that I believe that I was able to solve the mystery of why my car battery was dead in my garage twice in the matter of maybe a year or 6 months. It was a weird kind of thing. I know I didn't leave the door open. I know I didn't leave a light on. And yet I went into my car on two occasions and the battery is completely dead. This second time when I had to call somebody to give me a jump, the gentleman said, as soon as we jump this, I said, I can't figure out what happened. He said, well, as soon as the car turns on, we'll see what it was, whether it was a light or sometimes even if you leave on your hazard lights over a long period of time, when the car is off, it will drain the battery, especially overnight, 12 hours or so. And sure enough, it was the hazard lights. And I said, well, this makes absolutely no sense, because why would I turn my hazard lights on in my garage? So, of course, now I had a case to solve. I was my Columbo. I was Sherlock Holmes on this. I was Hercule Poirot, Agatha Christie's famous detective, Hercule Poirot, from Murder on the Orient Express, which was actually a pretty good movie if you saw that with Kenneth Branagh recently. So I used my deductive skills, and I solved the mystery. My tollway transponder had been falling off with regularity from my windshield, and especially in the summer. And the adhesive for the Velcro that was on the windshield and on the back of the transponder on the windshield was being melted by the hot sun this summer. It was 90 degrees, 20 some times this summer? It's crazy. And I would frequently step into my car and find my transponder in all different places. Sometimes it would fall off the windshield and fall into the cup holder. And sometimes it would be on the floor by the driver's seat. Sometimes it would be on the floor on the passenger side. It would be on my car seat. It was always, someplace except where it's supposed to be, on the windshield. I deduced, because it was on the floor when I got into the car, when the battery was dead, I deduced, strangely enough, and this could be right out of a Columbo episode, right out of a Murder, She Wrote, right out of a Sherlock Holmes, Sir Conan Doyle story. While the car was in the garage overnight, the transponder fell off, hit the dashboard right underneath where the transponder was on my windshield. The hazard light button protruded, apparently enough for the transponder to have fallen, hit that button, turning on the hazard lights as the transponder continued its journey to the floor of the car. But still, the damage was done. I was in my house, unable to, with the garage door closed. I had no idea that the hazards were flashing in the car overnight. And therefore, when I came in the next morning, the car and battery, the battery was dead. Car was not moving. So that was my deduction. I was very proud of that. I repositioned the transponder. I put new Velcro and repositioned the transponder on the other side of the rearview mirror, out of the direction of the hazards. And since then, no problems. And thankfully now summer's over, the warm sun is gone. But at least if it does keep falling off next summer, it will be falling in a different direction away from any buttons that can potentially drain my battery. As another detective said, the great Inspector Clouseau from Pink Panther, and the case is solved. So the case was solved. They have a room? A room? Yes, a room. So, flash forward to this past week. I have been rehearsing for a play that I'm appearing in, Arthur Miller's The Crucible. Very excited about it. Playing a very meaty role, if you will, of the judge who hangs the witches. It's a really fun role to play. Have the one of those big old judges' wigs on. This takes place in 1692. So I'm having some fun doing that. And so I'm at rehearsal, and I think I've talked to you about, this is once again, why you need to be binge-worthy. I've spoken to you in the past. For the last two or three years now, it's actually been going on for a while. It's been a while, I think, since I've spoken about it. So maybe newer listeners don't know. But about 3 years ago, I had a strange ailment, if you will. I had a blood vessel in my right eye burst. And long story short, it was serious in that I could have lost some vision, if not all of my vision, if this would had been, and I'd never felt it, and you don't feel it. Thankfully, your vision starts to blur a little, and you realize there's something wrong. And long story short, I don't know if it's even cure it, to treat this and to at least maintain it, and hold on to your hats here, folks. I have to on an 8 week basis, I get an injection into my eyeball. Believe me, it sounds a lot worse than it is, or maybe it's just I'm so used to it now. But your eye is numbed, and it is a little freaky because anything, as you know, around the eye is strange. But either I'm used to it, or the doctor is really good at it, and the eye is numbed. It takes about 2 seconds. It's very quick. It's still invasive, obviously, and it's still uncomfortable in terms of the whole process. But the actual injection is not painful. It's just awkward, if you will. And afterward, your eye is a little bloodshot, and, it's a little irritated for just about, a day or so. You go to sleep, you wake up, and the eye is clear, and everything's fine. But I had rehearsal the same night as I had one of these injections. And so, as I said, your eye's a little bloodshot. It can be irritated. And so I was going to wear a pair of my glasses. I do wear glasses for distance. It's not a very strong prescription, but it's a prescription. But I figure, my one eye is bloodshot, and there's a couple of scenes where I get right into people's faces. And so I said, well, maybe I'll just wear my sunglasses they're not even sunglasses, but they do have a tinted frame or a tinted lens. I said, well, maybe I'll just wear them tonight, so people don't have to look at this bloodshot eye and wonder what's going on. But as the day went on, I got the shot early in the morning, and the rehearsal was in the evening. And so as the day went on, my eye lessened in terms of the bloodshot look. And so I initially was going to wear them. And then I'm like, well, I don't know if I wear them inside, are people like, what the heck's going on? And then I have to, why are you wearing your glasses on inside? And then, because they are tinted. And I frequently do wear them, indoors. But, sometimes people think they're sunglasses. This is all this craziness that goes on in my head. I mean, ultimately, who cares, right? I'm so worried about such BS stuff, but what can I say? That's the way my brain works. So I get to rehearsal, and I've got them on for a while, and I'm not I'm not going on yet. And then I'm looking around. I'm like, oh, my eye's fine. So I, and this is the great mystery now. So I assume that I put these glasses, and they are my one of my favorite pairs of glasses. I put them in my bag that I have with my script and other things in it. Once again, this is a reason why I love the summer, the winter and the spring, or the spring, well, early spring. I love fall and love winter because I have to wear a coat. And when I have a coat, I can put everything in my pockets. I love coats and I love pockets. I hate the summer because if you're a man, there's nowhere to put stuff. There's nowhere to put your wallet. There's nowhere to put your phone. There's nowhere to put your keys. If you put them in your pants, there's bumps and it's all, ugh. That's why I love winter and I love fall because I wear a nice long trench coat. I've got as many pockets as Harpo Marx, and I stash things in pockets and I never lose anything in the winter. But it's always a pain in the butt in the summer. You know, give my wife here, take this stuff. I don't want to be, you know, weighed down and all bunched up with keys and phones and wallets and ugh. So I actually blame summer and the extended summer that we've had this year, at least we had a few weeks ago, for sadly the loss of my favorite pair of glasses. Talk about retracing steps. It's been about 2 weeks, week and a half. I'm still retracing steps. I'm still going over this in my mind. I've had to buy, I mean, I use these for driving, so I have to get a new pair of glasses. I've just ordered some, and I'm waiting for them to come. And I've got a pair just like them with this. I've ordered a new pair with the same frames and the same lenses because I really like these glasses. But it's driving me up a wall because with all my deductive skills, so-called, and all of my retracing the steps, which up to this point has always been successful for me in finding, quote-unquote, lost items, because when you find them, they are no longer lost, correct? But this one is a mystery. This is one that I don't think Columbo or Clouseau or Holmes or Monk or any famous detective can figure out. I can't figure out where the heck these glasses went. I must have dropped them somewhere. And I know the time period. There was a day, an evening from when I finished my rehearsal around 10:30. To the next afternoon when I discovered that I didn't have my key, my glasses. When I didn't see them in the house, in the usual spot where I put all my things so that they're handy, my keys, my wallet, my phone, and my glasses, they were not there. So I assumed sometimes I will take the glasses off in the car and just put them in the cup holder. So when I didn't see them in the house, I assumed when I got into the car to run some errands, I assumed that they were in the car. When I got into the car, I looked and they weren't there. So then I assumed that they were in my bag that I had had the night before at rehearsal. So I still didn't see them in the house, assumed they were in the car, went to the car, not in the car, got to be in the bag. So every time I went to a new spot where the glasses were not, I still had a assumption of where they were. Oh, I must not have brought them with me into the house. I must have left them in the car. Oh, I did not leave them in the car. I must not have the drive home is not very far from rehearsal to my house. So sometimes, you know, I don't wear the glasses all the time. When I drive, it just depends how my eyes are feeling. And so sometimes it was a quick drive and, you know, the I assumed the glasses were in the bag, so I didn't even take them out. That was my assumption. So when I finally get home from running my errands, I go into the house, I go to the bag, and I open the bag, and usually they're always in one of those three places. On the counter, where I leave my things, in the car, in the cup holder, or in my bag. And obviously in the winter, as I said, if not, then I won't have the bag, and I will have my coat, and I'll look in my pocket, and that's where my glasses will be. But this time, not in any of the three places. So now it's time to, what, gang? Retrace the steps. So now I'm retracing. I go into the car, and I scour the car under the mats, under the seats, in between the seats, in between the, you know, the console and the seat, in the glove compartment, in the visors, everywhere, back seat, front seat, under seat, you name it, side, somewhere, not in the car. Look in the bag. Many little secret compartments in the bag. Dump the bag out. Even though I went through it, I still turned the bag over and shook it. Opened up every zipper that it had and shook it in every possible way. No glasses. Looked in the clothes I wore. Did I put them on my pants? No. On my shirt? No. Nowhere. Did they fall somewhere? Looked in the yard, looked in the garage, looked in the kitchen. There was only a few places I would have been in those hours. Had rehearsal the next day, went to the rehearsal space. Nowhere to be found. Maybe someone found them. Maybe I dropped them in there. Someone found them and took them. I don't know. Went to where I parked the car at the rehearsal spot and retraced my steps that I walked from the space to my car, looked around, nowhere. Just baffled. I went to a store, and here's the one. The day that I was driving around them and realized I didn't have them earlier in that day, I went to the cemetery to visit my mother's grave because it was her birthday. And so now this is the next day. Thankfully, the cemetery is not that far away, 15, 20 minutes. I drove to the cemetery back the next day. Talk about the ultimate in retracing steps here, folks. This became a mission. When I lose something, I'm serious about finding it. I like my deductive skills. I like to prove my deductive skills. So I went back and drove to the cemetery and retraced my steps of where I, and it, there's only a short little spot. My parents are entombed in an outdoor mausoleum, and it's, you pull right up to it. They're right there. In fact, my mom was all happy. She said, oh, this will be, that's the way some people think. My mom is so crazy. She's like, well, here, this is going to be a nice crypt for us because it's right here on the bottom level, and yet we are raised from the ground. So if there's any flooding, we won't get wet. I love the way people think about this stuff. But at the same time, we're right here at the bottom. It'll be easy to find us. And you park the car, not even, you know, 50 yards away. You're right here. It's perfect. And it really is convenient now. Sadly, when I have to use this, when I go to visit them. So they did some good planning. But I went back to the cemetery, parked where I did, looked around the grass where I would get off, the sidewalk, the little bench, and everywhere. Glasses not there. So it's been about a week and a half, folks, and I'll tell you, even though I have gone and I ordered a new pair of glasses, this is still driving me crazy, and I still am expecting. Hope against hope. I am usually not that optimistic, but for some reason, I think that I am going to find these glasses somewhere, sometime, someday. Because this doesn't make any sense. I had to have put them in that bag. I had to have. So I must have, so I clearly must have dropped them somewhere between leaving the rehearsal space, going to my car, and then from my car in the garage to my house. That's the only place I could have gone. Because that next day, the only place I went was the cemetery. So, and I went back there. So I must have dropped them and someone picked them up and took them, which is kind of strange. They may have thought they were sunglasses. They're nice glasses, but they are a prescription. So if they don't wear glasses, it's not going to really do them much good unless they swap them out. I mean, I don't know. But this, I'm still holding out hope against hope that I'm going to find these things because it just doesn't make sense. I'm thinking maybe they fell in some little weird crevice somewhere. Or I put them somewhere just absentmindedly because I had them on and I was doing something else when I came home. But I cannot believe that these glasses are missing. And even more importantly, I'm really upset that my record up to this point, my sterling perfect record for the most part of finding things that I think are lost, and I have a long, you know, just because I don't find them in 5 minutes doesn't mean I think they're lost. Perfect example. When I was a little kid, I had a little nightlight in my room of the Scarecrow from The Wizard of Oz. And once again, I've mentioned many times, my mom was a great pack rat. Some things she kept were ridiculous. But some things from my childhood, she really, I'm thankfully, she kept so many things of my childhood, and I still have many of them, and they bring back some great memories. And so I had this this nightlight, which I remember clearly having in my room as a very little kid. And I thought it might be fun. My godson Patrick's got a son now. He's about 1.5 years old. And so I thought I would give, I don't have children myself. So I thought, well, this might be a cool gift to give him Max, little Max. My Scarecrow nightlight. It's not scary. It's a cool looking thing. And I know that I'd seen it. If you remember, once again, last year when I was talking on this podcast, go back and listen. Go to the landing page. I was decluttering last summer and went through many, many bins that we had stacked here in the basement. And I threw a lot of stuff out and rearranged all these bins that I had. And I knew for sure that I kept this nightlight because I loved it. And it did bring back, it was just a nice little memory. And I did think in the back of my mind even then, it might be cool to give this to Max. But I was going through some of the bins where I assumed it was, and it was not there. Which kind of frustrated me. But I was on a mission, and I said, well, if it's not in this exact bin I thought it was, it's got to be somewhere else. And sure enough, I went through some other bins, which I did have marked, and I even had a list of what number bins were. And sure enough, I found the nightlight. So, you know, a year later, or 6 months later, I've been looking at this thing for like 3 or 4 months, and I still stayed with it and found the nightlight. But these glasses, I mean, You don't put your name and your phone number on a pair of glasses, right? Now I'm thinking I should. But man, it just bugs the heck out of me because I really like these glasses, and it really bugs me that I don't know what the heck happened to them. I wish I would have dropped them and they smashed or something. At least I would have known. Now, it's a mystery that is going to be gnawing at me. Where are the glasses? Elton Jim's The Case of the Missing Glasses. Don't worry, folks. I'm on the case. I am confident I will find them. And when I do, you will be the first to know. And welcome back to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. And now we take a stroll to the Pop Culture Club. We do the secret knock. I don't know if that's a secret knock. And Emily answers the door, gives the handshake. Correct. And now you are allowed to enter. Emily Armanetti, hey. Welcome into the club.
Hey, Jim. Thank you.
Yes. So, I had to laugh.
I feel so welcome.
I had to laugh because I got an email from Emily this week, and she said, well, what topics are we going to talk about today when we record the podcast? And my response was, does it matter?
Because if we make a list of topics, it's almost certain we will not.
Yeah, I didn't even make one today.
By asking you for a list of topics, it's really more me trying to figure out what do I not need to be prepared
for. Well, that's actually, and I was thinking about this. It's actually a compliment to you.
Oh, yeah?
Because I don't feel at this point that I need, I feel that I'm very comfortable in speaking with you, and I feel comfortable in whatever topic I may bring up or whatever tangent we may go on, that you certainly can keep up and add to the conversation. So it doesn't really matter, unless there's some kind of a specific information, like a list of things, like if we're talking about Academy Awards or things like that, to have some, information.
Some reference.
Yeah, at your hand. But it sounds as if you have your computer or your internet machine right with you, right?
I sometimes do. Although, my computer is really on the fritz, so half the time it's not even working.
Oh, okay.
But that said, my mind is a steel trap for totally useless information. So,
yeah.
So,
like I said, I actually think that it's a compliment.
Oh, thanks.
To you that we don't need to
take it as such.
Sit there and be overly prepared for a topic.
Oh, God, no.
Or that I could just throw at you and we could hit. Now, the funny thing is, so before we actually started recording today, and I actually think this is my point. I thought it was kind of...
Actually, you're making me laugh. The thought of me being overly prepared for anything is kind of hilarious because I feel that I mostly go through life on the back foot. You know what I mean?
Oh, like, believe me.
Constantly feeling like I'm on the back
foot. Yeah, like, no, I do prep and I do... But it's not really, what's so funny is like even when I'm hosting a radio show on the air, on the radio, I make up a fairly detailed rundown of things I want to talk about with bullet points.
Yeah.
And the funny thing is though, so when I'm typing that up and writing that up, it's all there. And then the funny thing is when I'm talking on the radio, I never look at it.
Right.
And yet, when I'm done, I mentioned every one of the bullet points.
Well, maybe I think if you've made a list, it's seeping into your brain somehow. You know what I mean? It's getting in there.
Yeah, that's the irony.
That's like one of the ways that I used to study for exams.
Right.
I used to, I could read, I would read the material, but then I would also write down as I'm reading, and then that helps me.
I mean, I have to laugh because sometimes when I'm done with a topic and I go to the commercial, I look at the list and I go, oh, I didn't even look down. You know, why didn't I look down? Then I look and I go, oh, I nailed all of them. You know, I didn't even look down and I nailed them. And even I don't know, you know, what a photographic memory really means. But I think I must have that to some extent, because like even when I'm in the middle of rehearsing for a play now, and I've got quite a few lines, and I can picture the page. I know where that line is.
Yeah.
On the page. You know, it's like, no, that's not until the middle. You know.
Well, and that's good too, because I guess when you're doing something, I've never done anything like that, because the only production I have ever been in was like, you know, sixth grade Wizard of Oz, and my part was the speaking chorus, which basically meant I was just standing there on the stage. I had no lines. I was not singing. I think I was dressed like a munchkin.
There you go. That's fun.
But, right? But the thing about it that amazes me is, like, not only do you have to know your lines, but you kind of have to know other people's lines, because you need to know when.
You definitely have to know other people's lines. Oh, my God.
That's a lot. I couldn't do that.
It's well, and that's why, you know, what I do is I highlight my lines in yellow, and the couple lines before me, before my next line, in light blue. And so first I memorize my lines, and then I start to go back and look at the line before mine. But a lot of times I will know my lines initially in the, you know, process just by the order that my lines come in, because I could close my eyes and say, okay, there's the four lines, you know, I know, and it's like, no, we're, you know, that's in the middle there, you know. And sometimes even, like I said, early in the rehearsal, when people are still struggling, I'll be like, no, it's on the top of the page, you know, I do have a pretty good memory. So the point is that a lot of the stuff, like you're saying, I always did very, when we used to take those standardized tests in school, mm-hmm. I always did well on reading comprehension, you know?
Okay. Yeah.
Always mm-hmm. did well on that. So I will be able to, like you said, you know, you in your regular routine of going online and reading stories or reading in the newspaper, whatever it is, magazines, if I'm reading that is really enough. It does go in and it stays in. And then later on when I need it, the recall is there. And they, like you said, and then you said, if you make that list, it seems as if the actual physical act of making that list helps you to once again ingrain it in your memory. Okay, I have no idea. Oh, yeah, no. So what we were talking about. So what we were talking about was a list of topics. And so I thought it was kind of cool before we went on. We were just talking about scrambled eggs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And of course, Beatle fans will know that the song Yesterday was originally called Scrambled Eggs.
Did you know that?
See,
yeah,
once again.
I've heard that.
And you found that just by reading it somewhere, and it stayed in your mind.
Paul McCartney, didn't he come up with like the melody first?
Yes, but he had no words. He was like, scrambled eggs.
So he just threw some.
Instead of yesterday, it was scrambled eggs. Yeah. Well, anyway, you were saying that you were having some scrambled eggs just before we were going to record, and we got into what I thought was a kind of an interesting discussion, at least. Maybe we'll see.
About scrambled eggs, yeah.
Yeah, and it is one of the to me, if you are a scrambled egg aficionado, I really would be, this is where I would love to be on the radio, be able to talk to people and get immediate reaction. Because there has been, and you mentioned, that you sometimes put milk in your scrambled eggs.
Right.
And then you recently heard a well-known chef saying that doesn't really matter.
Yeah. Well, we can say it's Anthony Bourdain, right?
Yeah.
The late, great Anthony Bourdain.
And so he was anti-milk.
I was reading a roundup of, like, it was basically a roundup specifically about famous chefs and what their they say is like the key to like the perfect scrambled eggs. And so that Anthony Bourdain said, don't add milk. There's no need to do it. Doesn't add any value. I might disagree with him, but I don't like to overload like on dairy. So I've started passing on the milk, and they still turn out fine.
Well,
but I think they are fluffier with milk.
Yeah. Well, that's always what I always heard that if you put milk in your scrambled eggs, they will be fluffier. Now,
yeah.
This is what made this conversation interesting to me. So I was saying that I had always put milk in, and early on, before foodies had a title, and before there was anything, there was a show on PBS, and before there was, I mean, there was all, PBS really, what's interesting is, you think about the early days of cooking on television, and now as I'm thinking about this, it really was PBS that was the forerunner in that. Because they were the first ones to put Julia Child on.
Yeah.
You know, the French chef. And then and then in the 70s.
Well, she's not really French. Was she French?
No, she wasn't.
She just lived in France.
Yeah, well, she studied in France.
Yeah, yeah.
But so Julia Child was like the first one who really took, you know, television and cooking on TV to a new level. And then in the 70s, there was the Galloping Gourmet, who was this British guy that was very flamboyant. and that was the joke.
This, again, you were telling me like, ooh, I have the scrambled eggs story, but it's not very politically correct. I get everything. You always make everything somehow becomes politically incorrect. But carry on.
Well, that's my charm.
He was very flamboyant.
Yeah. So he was called. His name was Graham. I can't remember his last name now. Graham something. But he was very popular in the 70s, Galloping Gourmet, and he had this British accent. So, he was, you know, at that time, that was very, you know, exotic,
yeah,
especially on American television. And he would be, you know, hello, no, and he was, like, very messy. You know, Julia Child, he was, like, the antithesis of Julia Child, because Julia Child was, if you remember, if you ever watched her, she was very exact and you know, very neat. And the Galloping Gourmet was always looked like he was drunk half the time. And he was always messy.
He probably was.
Yeah. Oh, and he was all, and there was always the sides, you know, while he was right, you know, he's talking about something, was always all over the place. But, you know, and that was kind of the shtick. And then you didn't really have a lot of big cooking people. And all of a sudden you had the rise of the, you know, the Food Network, and you had your Emeralds and now your Bobby Flays and your Giadas and all these people.
Oh, yeah.
But there was, so I mentioned.
And don't forget my favorite, the Barefoot Contessa.
And the bad Barefoot Contessa.
Oh. Oh, no. What do you have against her?
My husband and I really love
Jeffrey. They just love each other. It's
Jeffrey
fine.
Really loves mushrooms. And so what I will do is take the mushrooms and I will soak them overnight. And it's amazing how they really get soft, and Jeffrey loves a soft mushroom. Oh. Energy! Pick it up, Contessa! Oh! You know, there's, and then you got one side of the thing with Emeril, with those BAMs and all that.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and
yeah.
And Jacques Pepin. You know who he is, Jacques Pepin?
That name sounds familiar.
He's the French guy. He's on, you obviously never watch PBS.
No, you don't. As we have already discussed.
Yeah.
Okay, I just finished watching The Sopranos.
I mean, but like my gosh.
Ago,
I mean,
okay? I don't have time for
PBS. I don't even realize how much I watch PBS until I regurgitate this. Yeah. Now. So, oh, my God, that's all I do.
Well, that's the other question. When are you doing all this PBS watching?
I don't know. Well, Saturday afternoon here, at least in Chicago, on Channel 11, good old Channel 11, they've got their Saturday is pretty
now,
much.
Is that WTTW?
Yes, the Windows to the World.
Yeah.
they have a whole block of food shows, basically from 10 in the morning until 5 at night. And that's where I watch my America's Kitchen.
Okay.
And I watch my Market Street and with Christopher Kimball now, who used to be on America's Test Kitchen, and I watch Check Please, and then we always watch Travel Channel, and then the Food Network. But what I was mentioning, so the milk, well, I always put milk in. I was always taught that. Oh, you should put milk in your. But then I was watching, and this surprised me that you'd never heard of this guy. One of the early, and I would say the late 80s, early 90s, a very popular TV chef on PBS, of course, was a guy called the Frugal Gourmet. And his guy's name was Jeff Smith. He was a reverend, some kind of an Episcopal reverend, I believe. And he was the rage before there was a Food Network, before there was an Emerald. He sort of picked up the gauntlet as... you know, what's her name? Julia Child wasn't as popular.
It's like the male Julia Child?
Yeah, sort of. But his whole thing, because he wasn't overly religious, but he would bring in the whole thing about, oh, you know, you should, cook with your kids. And it's this whole familial kind of, experience and the bountiful, you know, plates and, you know, food and this communal thing. So he would always bring a little of that kind of religious, but it wasn't overly. But he was very popular. He had a ton of cookbooks. He had his regular show. He used to do live thing. He was very popular. And then, sadly for him and his large following, he wound up getting in some trouble with some inappropriate relationships with young children. And that completely destroyed his career in a second.
Well, yeah, as it should.
Yeah, and then he died soon after that. I don't know if one had anything to do with the other, but the Frugal Gourmet, as much as the result wasn't good. We used to watch him. We still have many of his cookbooks. In fact, when we bake bread, we use his shaker bread recipe. But Frugula, I used to call him Frugula. Frugula would put water in the eggs and claimed that it made them fluffy.
Yeah.
So I don't know now, but you have never heard of Jeff Smith or Frugal Gourmet, right?
No.
Wow.
I think that was just slightly before my.
Yeah, it must have been. Well, clearly you don't even want you. I mean, do you know what Sesame Street is?
I was watching. I'm still trying to finish the Great Space Coaster. So don't tell me.
My gosh. I mean, okay? do you
it's
know who
on Netflix right now?
Do you know who Ernie and Bert are?
I do.
You're probably too young for the electric company, right?
They were in the news recently.
Yeah, well, that's why I'm bringing that up. Yeah, that's why I'm bringing that up. Are you too young for the electric company?
No, I watched the electric company.
Oh, yeah, with Morgan Freeman? And
the electric company, yeah. We watched Sesame Street.
Yeah.
And then we watched The Great Space Coaster. Was that after
you? I remember I remember the song, Great Space Coaster.
They did a great theme song.
Yeah, I remember the great.
Get on board.
To the Great Space Coaster. Yeah.
We'll explore.
Now, do you remember? Now, this might be too young
now
for you.
Now you're getting the gist of why I was in the speaking course.
Yeah, right. Now, do you remember a show called Zoom on PBS?
Now, is this related to the Happy Birthday song that every kid had? It was like, my name is Zoom and I live on the moon.
Oh, but no, I don't think so. No, this was
the
a
happy
show.
Birthday. Oh,
no.
My gosh.
This was a show that was out of, in the early days of, it seemed as if in the early days of PBS, Chicago, as we talked about, WTTW, and the Boston public station were very prominent in the original programming. So this was a show called Zoom. It was a kids show. It was a bunch of kids that were just running around. I don't know why it was called Zoom. It really, you can look at it. I'm sure it's on YouTube. It was called Zoom. I remember the song, come on and zoom, 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 zoom. Come on and zoom, 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 zoom. Come on, give it a try. We'll help you to fly high. Come on and zoom. And then there was
that is intense.
Yeah. And then there was even a language on Zoom called Ubby Dubby, like Hubby Frabrens.
What?
Yeah. It was almost like Pig Latin, but it was for Zoom.
I was gonna say.
And you would say Hubby Frabrens. You would put like this B in the words. And then
this is sounding more annoying than Barney.
It was. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Like I said, go on YouTube, because there was this giant letters that said Zoom. And it was a bunch of little kids that would, they used to wear like striped shirts, I think I remember. And they were all very obnoxious kids, but there was always the same kind of cast. And then they would just do things. They would run around and they would play games. It was really a dumb show. But this was in the early 70s when there was so little on television. I had to laugh. This was such a cool observation, which it never dawned on me, especially now when you talk about people that are in their teens or in their 20s or even their 30s with so many entertainment options. Do you watch American Horror Story? Are you watching it?
Oh, yes, yeah. Of course. So I never miss it.
I had to love a recent episode where these people are to go to be you know, quickly, the new episode of American Horror Story, the new serial, is there's these people that are, there's an apocalypse that's happened, a big nuclear bomb or something went off, and these people are all in a bunker from different areas of society, and there's this very one rich spoiled, you know, the spoiled girl, the blonde haired one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so I think she was talking to Joan Collins, who plays a pretty, she's basically a Alexis from Dynasty, yeah. You know, yeah. In the...
I like her character. Yeah,
but so she was arguing with this young girl about history or about something, and the young girl said to her, hey, don't blame me just because you had three channels and you had nothing to watch, you had no options of entertainment. And I can't remember her whole spiel, but her basically was saying that, you know, oh my God, you know, you lived in the dark ages, you know, when you grew up, when there was only three networks and no, you know, access and no internet. And it was funny, like, what a difference that time was. It really was. And that's why there were these shows when I was growing up that weren't even very good, but you watched them.
You still watch them. It was a simpler
time. Because there was nothing else on.
Right.
You know, and now, I mean, the sad part is we have more options and there are still horribly bad shows on. Now there's just more places to watch bad shows.
A lot more.
Yeah, there's just a lot more bad shows. At least back then, there always seems to be the level of poor quality always seems to match the availability. So when you had three networks and a PBS, you had a certain level of really bad programming. Now that we have a million options, we have a lot more bad programming.
Yeah.
To have on because they need to fill it in. That's what's so funny. It's like, you know, everybody has a show. Yeah. But not all shows are good. There was a reason why not everybody was on television.
Right.
And we're seeing it now. No, you know what? I got news for you. Everybody does not have talent. And today is the proof of that. But yeah, I mean, it was such an interesting thing to find that I thought that everybody knew who Frugal Gourmet was. But anyway, no. We get back to it. So are you still putting milk into the eggs or not?
I mean, like this morning, for example, I did not. But occasionally, I'll just throw some in. It's just, it's whatever my whim is.
Yeah, well, it is. And that's how I am with, because I go back and forth with the water and the milk.
Like I said, I grew up making scrambled eggs with milk, and, you know, a little splash of milk.
Right.
But I don't think it's crucial anymore. I don't feel the need to. So if I'm trying to...
Well, try the water. Don't go crazy.
Okay.
You don't have to dilute the egg, but try a little splash of water. See if it makes a difference. And as I said, I recently saw, as we all make, I would assume we all make scrambled eggs, and you put the big, you get a nice big chunk of butter, and you let it yes. just sizzle on the skillet there.
Yep.
But I saw someone recently on a show use olive oil, which I thought was interesting. So mm-hmm. and I tried it. And it was pretty good too. So that's another, you know, kind of I guess I don't know what would you call that agent. Why butter? Is butter there? I mean, I always thought that butter was there to stop it from sticking.
Yeah.
But now we have Teflon.
Olive oil can do that too.
But now we have Teflon.
Yeah, but you can't just put the egg straight on the Teflon. You still need to have some agent.
Yeah. Well, right? So try a little splash of olive oil. And I also found out what was interesting from this same show is that I've always seasoned my eggs with pepper, but I used to put the pepper in the scrambled mixture before I cooked it, and this chef said that you should always season after you cook. Mm-hmm. You should not season during.
Right.
And now you were saying that if you were making a scramble like you this morning, explain. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't even know what this means. I don't think you like eggs.
I don't love scrambled eggs are not my favorite form of egg. It's actually a sunny side up, followed by hard boiled.
Scrambled
is not even in my top.
Oh wow, no. See, sunny side, I don't like the goop.
Yeah.
Because it reminds me of an egg. It reminds me of what it really is.
Yeah.
Yeah. It reminds me of the incubator at the Museum of Science and Industry, of what's really going on in that egg.
I know. I have to. Well, there's a lot of food that I have to try not to.
And then the hard boiled. Now, do you have egglets?
Yeah. No.
Do you ever see egglets?
But I think that's not for, you mean those little cups?
Yeah, that's how you make a hard-boiled egg where you don't.
No, that's how you make that's more for soft-boiled, not hard-boiled.
No, because the whole idea of the egglet is that you pour the egg in the egglet and you don't have to peel it.
Oh, you pour the egg in it. Oh, see, now that sounds disgusting.
No. Did you ever see it work? I don't like hard-boiled eggs, really, so it doesn't matter.
Now I'm going to tell you the perfect method for hard-boiled eggs, which comes from Martha Stewart. You put the eggs in the pot, then cover with water, maybe like an inch over the edge. Then you bring the pot, cover, bring it to a boil. As soon as it starts to boil, you turn the stove off. 12 minutes later, you have perfectly boiled, hard-boiled.
Well, you know the problem with that is I have no patience. I can. That's why I love pasta, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I never have it.
Because you have to wait for the water to boil?
It takes too long to make.
Now I'm going to change your life. You need to get an induction stove. An induction stove, which is what happened to be in the house that we bought in Austin. So I did not myself, decide, oh, we're going to get one of these. But it boils water like super fast.
Really?
In fact, there are times when I put the water on and I go to do something else, like empty the dishwasher, and all of a sudden I hear this noise and I'm like, oh my gosh, it's the pot boiling.
Wow.
It happens so fast with induction.
And what does that mean, induction?
It's somehow magnetized. I don't know. I don't know exactly how it works. But from what I hear, it has to do with magnets. I don't know. But
I don't know if I want magnets cooking my food.
Here's the thing. When you get, like, if you were to decide, you and Jamie tomorrow decided, okay, we're getting an induction. We're going to replace our stove. We're getting an induction stove. You would need to test out your pots. Okay. If a magnet sticks to your pot, then it will work on the induction stove. If it doesn't, you have to get
get a whole new.
We had like one pot
that worked
and a wok that worked with this new everything else. So we ended up giving our other stuff to my sister-in-law has it, I think. But that's the thing. You might have to buy all new.
Well, I don't think I'm going to do that, but
your water will boil almost immediately.
I love pasta, but I never have it because I cannot wait for the water to boil. It is too long.
All of cooking involves some element of waiting. So what do you?
Well, but that's why. But to your point, But to your point, that's why I love a scrambled egg.
Right. Yes.
You could make scrambled eggs in 4 minutes.
Minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. Minutes. And that's why I love a scrambled egg. That's why I love bacon. Never make bacon.
Well,
takes too long.
It does. I know.
Bacon takes too long.
My scrambled eggs. What I do is I do use butter, but I can try the olive oil. I'm not opposed to that.
Yeah, just try me. Yeah, just give it a shot one time. Because my point is, get back to the thing. You don't even taste the egg. Tell everyone what you put. So now here's your nice, fluffy scrambled egg. And then what happens to it?
Well, first I saute a little bit of diced red onion.
Which is fine. Just a little soft, right? That's fine.
Then I put the eggs in, scramble them up. Then I plate it. And then I
Oh, here we go. Bad foodie term.
It's very official. And then I put some avocado, sliced avocado, a little bit of sea salt, and then I sprinkle cayenne pepper.
Oh my God, where's the egg? There is no way you taste egg.
It's delicious. But you know,
cayenne pepper has to kill the entire taste of the egg.
No, it's nice. I don't put that. You know, I don't put too much.
You're using the egg as a base to put your avocado and your pepper on something.
Well, but also, here's what I'm trying to do, okay? I'm trying to have, like, some good protein. Avocado is very good for you.
Oh, I love avocado. Yeah, definitely.
Okay. And then, you know, you have to have a little bit of, you know, you need a little bit of,
well, so
you
I
put
like,
pepper on. You put pepper on yours.
Right, I put pepper. But really, yeah, but I don't put, but cayenne pepper is pepper on steroids. I mean, you're going to the next level here.
It's just a spice. You know,
I understand that, but it's certainly hotter and more intense than your regular black pepper.
It's got a little kick.
Yeah. You don't taste egg. You might as well put it on a muffin.
But again, scrambled egg is not my favorite form of egg anyway. So, you know, I don't mind that I'm not.
But yeah, I am very, I have no patience. Like I said, I enjoy cooking very much. My mom, I used to make the joke back when they used to have, remember the Swanson TV dinners? Is that before your time?
Mm-hmm. No, well, I remember them.
Yeah.
We didn't really
joke used to be, even when I was a little kid, this is how I knew I think I had a sense of humor. I would say, if Swanson doesn't make it, we don't eat it.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I mean, not that we used to have a lot of Swanson dinners, but my mom was not a very good cook, and she knew it.
But you're on your dad's side. You're Italian.
So yeah. So my dad, I think, must have learned from his mom. And my dad was basically the cook. Now, I pretty much, as a kid, I really stopped even, it was just my, you know, me and my mom and dad. But I probably, once I got involved with sports in grammar school, in like fifth grade or sixth grade, then I really stopped even having dinner with my mom and dad because I would have practice, you know, after school and I'd get home. And so the whole kind of familial dinner for me probably stopped when I was 11 or 12.
Yeah.
Because then I went to high school and I was playing sports there. So I'd always come home at 7 o'clock, 8 o'clock, you know, so never really had dinner with them anymore as much. But my early childhood, certainly my dad was more of the cook than my mom was, or we did have in those days, whatever was a fast kind of thing, whether it was, you know, something that you put in the toaster oven and then later, you know, you put into the, and we would have steaks and chicken and things like that. But
Italians, as you know, food is like,
my dad used to make soup, like Italian soup, escarole soup with the lettuce from scratch. He would make a lot of things from scratch. So whatever, you know, cooking thing I picked up, I certainly picked up from my dad, but ultimately I just don't have the patience. Like I hate the preparation, like the chopping, I can't stand. That's why if I cook at home, I need to be a TV chef, where all those little bowls are already pre-done.
Right.
To sit there and chop an onion.
You need like a production assistant.
I need a sous.
Come in and they do all.
Yeah, I need a sous chef living in my house.
Yes. And they do the grunt work.
Yeah, because I can't stand that. I love cooking, and I love putting it all together. And I make a mean fried rice.
Oh, really?
With my wok. Oh, yeah.
What do you put? Do you put, like, chicken or steak?
Oh, yeah,
What protein do you put?
Yeah. It depends, whatever we have.
Do you put egg in your fried rice?
Oh, definitely. You got to put egg in there. Yeah.
I mean, that's there is scrambled egg in.
Now, that I don't mind because in terms of the preparation, because it's all cooking so fast.
Okay.
You know, so you're throwing those things in and you're just.
But there's still a fair amount of ingredients.
There is. There's some chopping involved. Right? There's some chopping involved. But I remember one time I was watching Emeril on the early days of the Food Network, and he made some New Orleans, if you will, New Orleans beignets. You know what beignets are?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's fried. Delicious. They're so good.
Fried dough. It's
like fried dough. But you can put, but like he made zucchini beignets.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And I'm like, wow, that looks really good. So I said, I am going to make some beignets. So we had the Emeril book, and I got all the, the ingredients ready.
Did you say ingredients?
I always say ingredients. That's kind of my favorite malaprop. Okay. All the ingredients. All the ingredients ready, and oh my god! So I mean, and they were good, and I finally got done, and it was good.
Yeah,
but it took like 3 hours to make 10 beignets. We ate them in 40 seconds. And I'm like, okay, wait a minute. This was not worth the effort.
Well, see, now that's why when people go to New Orleans, they just buy the box of the mix.
Yeah. Right? I went, I made the batter. In fact, what's so funny, we still have, the Emeril cookbook. And when I go to the page of the beignets, where the recipe is, mm-hmm. the page is still filled with oil, grease.
a little bit of powder.
Yeah, there's powder, there's batter, there's like batter, oil stains on the page because there was so much going on.
All right.
And so
did
many...
Did you have to like deep fry them or hand with a lot of oil?
Well, you had to put them in a pan. We didn't have
a lot of oil. I bet though. You probably had to submerge them.
Yeah, well, you sort of had to turn them.
Right. Okay.
You didn't submerge them. It wasn't like you needed a fry daddy or anything.
Right.
But oh my god! I mean, it was such an effort, and I said, "These are very good, but I will never make them again." This was a 4-hour ordeal.
Yeah.
And that's like even, because Martha is on PBS too. And she's got a couple of shows now. And, once again, it's like, yeah, this is great. But look at the prep time.
Yeah, I know. I pick and choose. I prefer to stick to recipes unless it's like a family recipe, which my grandma never really wrote down recipes, but we all over time kind of just from watching her and my aunts watching her and my dad, we kind of replicate the stuff that she made. But otherwise, if I'm just making something, like if I'm seeing stuff, like if I see a Giada recipe or something or Barefoot Contessa, I will only do it if it's like 5 ingredients
right.
or fewer. Like I just can't. Yeah,
no, I just don't have the...
I have patience to prep. I just don't want to have too many things going. So
I don't mind that. I just the prep time is like was that dish worth the effort, or could I just go to a restaurant,
right?
And it's made for me, and yes, I'm paying twice as much, but at least I'm not. And then, of course, as I said earlier in the podcast, I'm Mr. Felix Unger. So, of course, while I'm cooking, I'm also cleaning.
Oh, I'm very big on that, too.
Yeah, I don't, like, my wife drives me crazy.
I know.
When she decides, because she's got 17 different spots on the counter, all incompleted,
Okay. If my husband makes waffles with the kids, okay, on like a Saturday morning, waffles. And we have a waffle maker,
right.
Okay? He makes waffles with the kids and bacon. And usually when he makes bacon, he doesn't even make it in a frying pan. He puts it, you can make it
right.
in the oven.
Yeah.
But somehow, between only really needing one bowl, waffle maker and oven.
Right. Man,
somehow, I get up and every single pot, pan, utensil.
I know.
Everything is
out.
Used.
And it's just sitting
and
there.
All over the place.
Oh, it drives me crazy. When I, like, for instance, when I'm, if I am making anything, and I sometimes bake some bread, I sometimes do some stuff like that. But if I crack an egg, I throw it away.
Yeah.
It doesn't sit on the counter.
No.
If I have a scoop of something that I have to get a teaspoon of something, you know, use my little spoons or my little, mm-hmm. you know, cups. I need a cup of this. If that's all if after I use the cup, if I don't need that again, it is washed out and put into the right away.
So here's the thing. Before I start cooking, the dishwasher is always emptied out.
Right.
It's a clean dishwasher. It's emptied out.
Exactly.
I start cooking. I have my main cutting board. Okay. So most of the food prep is done on that main cutting board wherever possible. And then my goal by the end of like the cooking process is that any other utensil or
right.
vessel
is gone.
Is rinsed, in the dishwasher,
right.
with the exception of the cutting board. And then that I will eat dinner and then I will rinse that off.
Yeah, no. Well, now, because Jamie likes to bake quite a bit. And she has now, because you know, if I'm in the kitchen while she's doing that, I will start to pick up after her, which drives her crazy. So I've actually been able to, I think, influence her because she doesn't want me following her around.
Right. So now she just does it herself.
Yeah. So now she's gotten, initially, it was World War VII. You looked like Hiroshima in the kitchen if she made a batch of cookies, you know. Now I go in there and you don't even know that she baked.
Right.
I'm like, that's wow. Good. And I just say, wow. And I don't even bring it up because I know that she's done it on her own. So I'm not going to, see that you're cleaning up now because blah, blah, blah. You know, I don't even bring that up. But clearly, you know, she realized that this was a disaster area for no reason.
Okay, but see, now I wish that would work in my house, but it doesn't. Because before I can even sit down and eat anything on Saturday morning, I'm cleaning up the Hiroshima bomb in my kitchen, okay? I can't even have my coffee until that's done because I can't sit there. It drives me crazy.
Oh, I know. I cannot stand.
And I'm not even like a super meticulous person. Like I don't like when the kitchen gets out of control.
Yeah, and it's very easy for it to get out of control. And like I said, I am so fastidious, and that's the irony too, is that once again, my dad was more fastidious and like than my mom was.
Mm-hmm.
It was so funny. My mom wasn't messy, but my dad was like, and I really got that. In fact, one of my biggest memories was Saturday morning. My dad was always vacuuming.
Oh, really?
My dad was vacuuming. And I remember I would get mad because I'd be watching American Bandstand, which was on at 11 in the morning.
Yeah.
And I would be sitting on the couch watching American Bandstand, and he would be vacuuming.
Right.
While Casey and the Sunshine Band were on. So I can't, not only can I not hear.
How dare he?
Yeah. Not only can I not hear the band on Bandstand, but then I'd be sitting on the couch. And he would be with the vacuum cleaner nudging my feet, lift my feet up.
Right.
So he could vacuum underneath where my feet were.
Now, you can't even lift your feet up for your poor father who's trying to vacuum.
Well, here's the best part. That used to bug the hell out of me, right? So now guess who vacuums in our house?
All right.
and while Jamie's sitting on the couch, guess who's nudging her feet with the vacuum?
Yeah, I can picture it.
And I'm like, oh, my God, I can't believe I'm doing this. Well, anyway, what did we learn today? I guess we learned after every time talking to Emily, we learned several weeks ago that you root for love.
Yeah, that was a while back.
Still haven't forgotten that. You root for love.
I do.
And now we realize that you put milk in your eggs, but now sometimes you don't, you still do, and that you
really
completely
anymore.
Overwhelm the taste of the egg with an odd grouping of avocado. I love how everybody has to use. I love how everybody has to use kosher salt or sea salt now. Regular salt
you
can't use anymore. Mm-hmm. I love the way that's become the new thing.
Yeah.
And then the one that just blows everybody's mind. The cayenne pepper on eggs.
I think it could be the Southwestern influence on me, you know.
Now, I do remember, I've never done this, but I had a friend of mine, his father And when I would stay over there, was when I first saw this ever happen, and I think I almost, you know, jumped out of my chair. He put ketchup on his eggs.
Oh, yeah.
And I've heard people do that. I never have done that. I like
no, a, I yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you got to like a little butter on top of the egg too.
No, I don't.
Do oh, that. You don't do that, huh?
No, okay.
But
no. Just a little bit in, just a little bit
yeah,
in the pan.
But he used to put ketchup, which it used to look. When I was a little kid, I was actually scared. It looked like a crime scene.
Yeah,
you know, so we did learn that you will even against the late Anthony Bourdain's suggestion, you will still put milk in your egg.
I will, but I was willing to give his advice a try.
Yeah.
You know,
and I would offer that you could look up Jeff Smith, the Frugal Gourmet, and mm-hmm. B, try some water in your eggs, and then also try a little olive oil.
Right. See, this is like the pop culture club test kitchen edition. Right,
exactly.
This is what we learned. Yeah, we got a lot of good tips.
Yeah, there were some good tips in here.
I like getting cooking tips.
Yeah, I know.
You know,
it's fun. So I'm like I said, I appreciate your culinary advice and insights. And once again, we have to thank Emily. Never boring, always informative.
never boring, never prepared.
Just the way we like, just like we like our food.
Right. As little prep as possible.
Exactly. We'll talk to you soon, Emily. Take care.
All right. Thanks, Jim.
And that completes episode 124 of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic right here at WGNplus.com. Every Monday, a new episode is posted. Hope you will continue to stop by and have some fun. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic from the end of the web to your screen.